Hey, it's you, man, from KC95 here. Good evening and welcome to Toasted Tavern. Your host, Scott Tobin, and the man called Wags are ready to bring you the night in sports. So pull up a stool, grab a drink, and let's get toasted.
Hey, good evening. Welcome into the Toasted Tavern. I am Wags, joined alongside by Scott Tobin here on a day where we're about, a couple of hours from a Major League Baseball lockout. First one since 1994-95, the strike. We are in a really, really bad shape when it comes to Major League Baseball, although you wouldn't know it by the amount of money that Major League Baseball teams are still throwing around. Before we get to that, Scott, good to have you back in. How you doing today, man?
I'm good, man. How are you? I'm doing all right. Sorry, I ended that really quickly. I'm doing good, man. Doing good. Yeah, you're right. We're getting closer to baseball Armageddon, but everything's going to be okay. And other than that, I'm doing good because December 1st, man, my favorite time of the year. We've officially hit the Christmas season. So how are you now, Wags?
I'm doing great because not only, like you said, not only is it the month of Christmas, the month of New Year's, it's also the month that Spider-Man comes out, No Way Home. I'm excited about that. Cannot wait for that movie to come out. So lots of really, really good things coming this month. And, you know, the Blues are playing okay. We'll talk about that game last night here in a little bit. What a funky and weird game that was. You got NFL playoffs are going to start ramping up here very soon. I mean, we're in the last couple of weeks of the season, and I know it's gonna be weird with 17 weeks, so we got all that going on. College basketball rolling along right now. I gotta talk a little bit about SLU tonight because they are doing what every other team in America right now isn't doing, and that's winning games that they're supposed to, but we'll talk about that later as well. But outside of that, you know, you have to talk about Major League Baseball because at about midnight tonight, well, more so 11 o'clock our time, we are about ready to have a lockout, and we'll talk about that in just a second, but we got to get to some of these other signings that went down today as teams are essentially continuing to throw money out there just about hours away from them not being able to spend money and maybe possibly changing the way they spend money, depending on how this CBA gets knocked out. But the big one we got to talk about right away just dropped really within the last hour or so, and that's the Marcus Stroman deal. For the longest time, you know, the Cardinals were in on him. You talked about teams on the West Coast, the East Coast, the Rangers all getting involved with Marcus Stroman. Not really sure what his value was going to be based on what other pitchers have gotten in the last couple of days. But out of nowhere, and I'm pretty sure this is out of nowhere, the Chicago Cubs come swooping in and sign Marcus Stroman, at least according to Marcus Stroman, to a three-year, $71 million contract. Now, Jeff Passan has since tweeted out that the particulars of the deal at 371. But were you shocked that the Cubs ended up getting in there and getting this deal done? Or was this something that maybe they were lying in wait, just like the Cardinals, to kind of see where his number fell?
No, I'm totally shocked. I'm shocked that the Cubs went and did this. I'm shocked that Stroman did it. This is a deal that really makes almost no sense for either one of them. I mean, the Cubs aren't going to be ready to compete next year. Stroman talked about wanting to win and proving something. That's not going to happen in Chicago. That team is going to be bad. And for the Cubs, it doesn't make any money. It doesn't make any sense either because you've bargain basement shopped. You've made a couple of moves. You signed Yan Gomes yesterday, which made Wilson Contreras so mad. He was liking tweets about him getting traded to the Cardinals to be Yadi's backup after this year. So you have to think that Contreras is probably on his way out in Chicago, which, you know, he's the last piece of those championship teams there. It really makes no sense, man. It's like the Cubs are just throwing money to say, oh, look, we spent some money. But what do they have? They got Marcus Stroman and a whole bunch of nothing. Jason Hayward. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense for me unless the Cubs are looking at Stroman as a guy that maybe they can flip at the trade deadline and get something more for him. I think it says more about the fact that there was no real market for Marcus Stroman. I mean, you know, you look at what some of these other guys got, and for Stroman to go to the Cubs for 3 years and $71 million, you would have thought that a team that was at least somewhat in contention would have jumped in there and said, okay, you know, we can afford that. We can make that move, but nobody did. So, and you have to wonder if Stroman being so vocal and being a little bit controversial on social media may have scared some teams off. You know, I mean, he took shots at the Mets. He liked a couple of posts that were kind of controversial this week when it comes to race relations. Did some things that probably didn't help his his value probably scared a couple of teams off. So, you know, Marcus Stroman maybe didn't do himself any favors. You know, and we talked about the Cardinals, you know. Yeah, I would have loved to have gotten Marcus Stroman too, but I think after you signed Steven Matz, I mean, in a lot of ways, Matz and Stroman are the same guy. I mean, they're, you know, they're both left-handed, they're both sinker ball pitchers. Neither one of them big strikeout guys. So I think the fact that the Cardinals jumped on Matz early and got him for, again, it just shows you what a deal the Cardinals got on Steven Matz, because the Cubs paid 3 years and 71 for Stroman. You got Matz for 4 and 44. So, you know, I think the Cardinals really came away with a really big steal there. And, you know, I know a lot of Cardinal fans are like, oh, Steven Matz, big deal. And I was like that to a certain extent because, you know, you are thinking Stroman or one of those bigger names. But like I said, I think when you look at their numbers, Matz and Stroman have been basically the same guy through their careers. And so I think the Cardinals really came away the winners when you look at what those two teams did with those two particular pitchers.
And the fact that you saw this insane amount of money being thrown around, and you do get a decently quality pitcher in Steven Matz for a very, very good amount of money. And of all the, I guess, crap that we've given, you know, John Mozeliak over the years and some of the bad contracts he has given out, the fact that he did get this deal done for a good amount of money. I mean, we talked about it on Monday. You're basically paying Matz over 4 years what Max Scherzer is getting every year in New York for the Mets. So if Matz even comes out and just gives you three quarters of what he did last year, I think you 100% have to call it an absolute win, because it still gives the Cardinals some freedom and some room to work with and to bring in other guys. And, you know, we talked about relievers possibly being brought in, talked about them potentially getting into the shortstop market. You know, one of those relievers that does, you know, that was with the Cardinals last year and is not going to be is Garcia, who goes to the Padres for 2 years and $7 million. That was a bit of a surprise. Considering, you know, that's kind of a low number, you know, $7 million over 2 years, it's still a decent amount of money, but I think that's something maybe the Cardinals could have, you know, swallowed in a sense and been okay with it. But, you know, you made a pretty good point when we were talking earlier today about the fact that, you know, Garcia came in off the scrap heap and did pitch a good half of a season, but we've seen what the Cardinals have gotten out of guys that they've just rushed out to sign after partial seasons. And not to say that Garcia can't go out and continue that, you know, in San Diego, but I understand maybe why they didn't want to go too far in offering a guy like Garcia that kind of money with only a small track record, like half a season.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny how fickle Cardinal fans are, because remember at the trade deadline when the Cardinals got Luis Garcia, oh, the Cardinals bargain basement shop and picking somebody off the junk pile. Who the hell is this guy? Now they don't sign him. And they're like, what the hell? You didn't bring back Garcia? What's wrong? What's Mo sucks? Fire Mo. I mean, you got to look at it this way. Like I said, the guy pitched a half of a season. He's been horrible for the most part everywhere else he's been in his career. And he's going to be 36 years old. You know, it's not like he's a kid. You know, you can go find another Luis Garcia for a whole heck of a lot less than $3.5 million a season. You know, if the Cardinals were really that interested, they would have jumped on him and signed him right away like they did with TJ McFarland. But it sounds like the Cardinals want to upgrade a little bit at that spot. It sounds like they're looking for a more high-end, back-end guy that's got a little bit more of a reputation, a little bit more history. You know, we've talked about Joe Kelly's name has come up a lot. Archie Bradley's name has come up a lot. There's a few other guys that have been listed as guys that the Cardinals seem to have some pretty serious interest in. So, you know, I think they're still going to do that, and they may still sign a couple of those guys. But I think, like I said, I think it was a situation where they looked at $3.5 million for Luis Garcia and said, you know what, at 36, we're going to let you take that and go to San Diego, and we'll do, you know, we'll figure it out from there. And, you know, the big thing, I know a lot of people are panicking. Oh my God, the Cardinals only made one move. Well, you know, there's a whole lot of teams. There's a whole lot of fan bases. Yankees, Red Sox really didn't do anything. The Dodgers finally did today. They went out and they re-signed their backup shortstop, super stub, Cardinal killer. You know, he's going back to the Dodgers. So that'll be big for them. But, you know, Dodger fans were panicking. But a lot of the big team market teams have not jumped into this yet. So, you know, I wouldn't panic, you know, and the guys that the Cardinals have been tied to the most, you know, the Trevor Stories, the Kyle Schwarbers, those type guys are all still out there. And, you know, there's some rumblings, and this could be really interesting. Talk about pitchers and reclamation projects. What do you think about Zach Greinke coming to St. Louis and maybe being a swing guy in St. Louis? You know, Greinke's 37, going to be 38, be that sixth guy, that long relief guy, kind of come into St. Louis. I mean, if he's willing to do it, there have been some rumblings that maybe the Cardinals have Zach Greinke on the back burner for a role like that.
I mean, he's a guy that I think the Cardinals have always been intrigued by, and we've seen countless times, especially over the last couple of years, guys that the Cardinals have talked about years in the past have eventually made their way here to St. Louis and have shown some success, you know, Goldschmidt, Arenado, those kinds of guys. So it definitely wouldn't be out of the question, out of the realm of possibility. He does have some familiarity facing the Cardinals with the Royals, with the Astros. So, I mean, it's not like he doesn't know what he would be getting himself into. That would be a really, really interesting move to make. And it's very possible that might be the direction that they go. And, you know, you mentioned Joe Kelly as well. I kind of want to jump back to Stephen Matz real quick because an acquaintance of ours for the longest time always just harped on the Cardinals for not having a left-handed starter in the rotation. And I'm a guy that I sit there and I go, it's not an absolute 100% need or necessity to have a left-hander in your rotation. But after seeing what guys like, J.A. Happ and John Lester did for the Cardinals season at the end of the year last year. You know, I'm not going to say I'm coming 100% around on the need to have a left-hander in the rotation, but having one in there does tend to throw things out of whack for teams when they have to adjust. Because if you can go out there and you just know every series you're going to be facing a right-handed starter no matter what, you can plan for that. But when you have to worry about, okay, is this the series we gotta face the lefty? Is it not this series? You know, how are we going to play that out? It does make things, you know, a little bit more interesting, and it does kind of change things up a little bit. So, you know, I'm glad that they got a guy like Matz in there because he is the lefty, and, you know, it gives you a little bit of a look as to what you might see, you know, when a Matthew Liberatore comes up as well. So it's not a bad deal, and they got him for good money. So I do like that. And, you know, not getting Luis Garcia, okay, not too worried about that. Like you said, he was a half-a-year wonder. And I think, honestly, that the Cardinals, even if they don't go out and get another reliever, I think they've got enough depth in their system. And I know they want somebody in there that's got some maturity and some experience and maybe even some championship pedigree. But they don't have to go out there and break the bank to bring somebody in because we've seen what they've done in that instance. You know, Andrew Miller was okay. You had Brett Cecil, total bomb. You had guys that you brought in that had that experience in championship caliber, and they just blew up. So why not spend the money on that, give your depth a chance, some of these younger guys an opportunity, because you have a bunch you can kind of throw in there and see what works, and spend that money on a guy like a Trevor Story, which, once again, may or may not happen. It doesn't sound like the Cardinals are actively going into the shortstop market right now, but it does give you that ability to maybe expand out the, okay, this is what we were willing to spend, but if we don't have to spend it on this, we can add a little bit more here, and maybe it makes it a little bit more palatable for them to go after a Story. I have no doubt in my mind they're not going to touch Carlos Correa with a $2,500 a year pull. He's not coming to St. Louis. He's going to command way too much money. But Trevor Story is going to be the guy that, for the Cardinals, he's the main target right now. And if they want him, they can go out and get him, but it's probably not going to happen here in the next, 2 hours and 46 minutes.
No, you know, and the thing about Trevor Story, you know, we keep hearing, oh, the Cardinals aren't interested. The Cardinals aren't interested. Well, we do have to remember that the Cardinals were interested at the trade deadline and at least made some kind of a trade offer to the Rockies for Trevor Story at the deadline. So the whole, you know, oh, we're totally committed to Paul DeJong and we have no interest in this. There's a little bit of a smokescreen there. You know, are they going to give Trevor Story, you know, $180 million or $200 million? Probably not. You know, if they could get Trevor Story to come here for a year or two, you know, improve himself, and then, you know, maybe you extend him after that, that would be something the Cardinals would potentially do. Because, I mean, if you could get him to come for 1 year, say you say, okay, Trevor, you can come to St. Louis. You know, we'll give you a 1 year deal for $27 million this year. Or you can go to Seattle, because apparently the Mariners have interest like they do in just about everybody. Or you can go to Seattle and sign a long term deal, and maybe you'll win in Seattle. Maybe they'll turn things around. Maybe it'll happen. But you still have to fight the Astros and the A's, and, you know, you're still in that American League. You come to St. Louis, you play here for a year. We give you $27 million. You play with your best friend, Nolan Arenado. You play with Yadier Molina and Adam Wainwright. You helped him try to win a World Series. And then next year, when, you know, Waino's $18 million are off the books and Yadier's $11 million are off the books, then we've had you for a year and we know what you're like. Then we can sit down and talk long-term contract. And I think that's the way it may work with Trevor Story. If they can make it work, you know, say, okay, you can go somewhere else and have a chance to win, or you can come to St. Louis and we really go for a World Series and are legitimate World Series contenders with you in the middle of this lineup. And, you know, we'll see, you know, how much pull does Nolan Arenado have? How much pull does a Matt Holliday have again? Does the opportunity to play with Yadi for that last year and Waino and chase that ring and do all of those things, does that entice him? You know, and we'll see. You know, from everything we've heard, it very well could. And then even if you do that, you still need another bat. You know, whether it's – you still need a left-handed bat, you know, as a part-time DH or an outfielder. You know, are you going to go get Kyle Schwarber? I don't know that you add Schwarber and Story. That would be a lot of money because Schwarber's going to take – you know, the days of Kyle Schwarber getting a one-year $18 million deal like he did last year aren't going to happen either because of the year he had in Boston. That's going to be a long-term commitment. So you're probably not going to get both of those guys, but you need two bats. And, you know, I know you've got Nolan Gorman coming in, you've got Yepez and all that stuff, but you still need – you don't want to go into next year with your whole bench being, you know, Lars Nootbaar, who, again, half a season looked really good, has looked good in the fall league, but let's see what happens when pitchers figure him out. And then have a Yepez and a Gorman who have no major league experience. You know, you don't want to have that. You don't want to have the bench that you had at the first half of the season last year that were basically five guys that none of them could do anything. You know, because you're still going to have, I mean, even if you have Paulie as your shortstop and you go with that situation, you have the backup. He doesn't have a lot of experience there either, you know. So you need at least one really legit major league bat off that bench. Preferably left-handed.
Yeah, I mean, I think lefty is definitely the target for sure when it comes to the bench. I mean, if you do go out and sign Story, though, is there a mature veteran lefty that you could go out there and sign for a lower value or a single year? I mean, I don't know. I mean, just kind of perusing, I haven't really seen anybody pop off that would be that kind of player at the monetary amount that the Cardinals were wanting. Is there anybody that you've seen that you could go, okay, yeah, well, we could find a way to get him here on a one-year deal that would fit if Trevor Story were coming to St. Louis?
You know, I mean, I'm sure there's somebody out there that we haven't thought of. You know, if you go get Trevor Story and you sign him to a one-year deal and you get a relief pitcher at a decent price, whether it's Joe Kelly, who you might be able to get at a decent price because the Dodgers are paying him $4 million of the option they didn't pick up. So you may be able to get Joe Kelly for $3 or $4 million, you know. And then if you get Story, maybe there's not a left-handed bat. Maybe that's the moment where you pivot and you go, okay, we have Trevor Story. We need a bat. We need a veteran bat. Yeah, he can't hit right-handers anymore. But there's this guy that can hit lefties. Him and Nolan Gorman could alternate as DHs, and maybe that's when the Cardinals pivot and say, okay, Albert, come on home.
Yeah, I mean, that would make the most sense. You know, and who better to learn underneath than Albert Pujols for a guy like Nolan Gorman, especially in that DH role. I mean, that would be the perfect guy to really instill a work ethic and what to look at as far as batter's eye. Now, I'll say this, Nolan Gorman has risen quickly through the ranks, so it's not like he can't hit. He may have the same sort of natural talent as a guy like Albert Pujols. Not in the same class, obviously, but he could have that same thing where all it would take was Albert to work with him for a year to really hone those skills, and he could be a very productive guy off the bench. So that would be, I think, if you were to poll Cardinal fans and you would say, okay, you either get this, Story, Albert, and Gorman, or you get Schwarber, Yepez, and you keep Paul DeJong. I mean, where do you think fans would go most? I think you're talking Story, Albert, Gorman. 98% of fans would want that, no question.
You would think so, although Cardinal fans are so weird. You know, I've seen so many Cardinal fans going, good. Don't spend any more money. You know, these are the same Cardinal fans that 3 months from now are going to be throwing a fit because they didn't spend any money. Yeah. But don't spend any more money. You know, we're good the way we are. You know, we don't need to do anything else. You know, okay. Let's hear that again in April if they don't make a move. Yeah, you know, Albert's kind of a lightning rod. You either really, really want him back or you really don't. But I think if you could, I mean, again, Albert's not going to fix all your problems. The only way Albert works is if you do go get a guy like Story or something like that, and then Albert is that just, okay, Albert, you're going to hit off left-handed pitchers. You'll DH against lefties. You may play first base every once in a while against the lefty. Goldie DHs, or you give Goldie a day off. But you're just not going to see the field against right-handed pitching, probably. You know, and, you know, if Albert would be okay with that and he would sign a couple million-dollar deal, then maybe it works. I will say that something that made me – that put that back in my head because I'd pretty much given up on the Albert coming back to St. Louis. Until Mo made a comment the other day, they asked him about, you know, what they were looking for. And he said, yeah, we need another bat. We need another legitimate bat. We need a bench bat. Preferably, we need somebody who could, you know, back up at the corner infield positions, especially like first base. And when he said that, I'm like, okay, who is he talking about there? You know, so again, am I confident Albert's coming back? No. And like I said, you have to make other moves, bigger moves, for that to work. You can't just bring Albert back and be like, okay, Albert's our DH. Now we're going to go win a World Series, because that would be a disaster.
Yeah, it would be an absolute disaster. And honestly, it'd probably be what Cardinals fans would expect out of the management of this team for the last couple of years, despite all of the amazing moves that have been made, bringing in guys like Goldschmidt and Arenado. Yeah, it's the crap moves that got made that are the reason this Cardinals team doesn't do anything. But we got to kind of pivot away from this, but it still goes hand in hand with what is on the horizon here. And by why a guy like Trevor Story or Correa or Albert haven't signed yet. And it's because of the contract negotiations that are going on, the collective bargaining agreement, because in this collective bargaining agreement, the universal DH is going to be a factor in this. And for the Cardinals, you don't sign Albert Pujols until you know that the DH is going to be in play for the National League next year, among other things. It's not the only reason that you don't sign Albert right now. It might be the reason Story and Correa haven't signed as well, because they don't know which teams may be looking for a DH. Because if the National League gets a DH, that opens up every single National League team to potentially putting a contract out there for those guys, because they have an open spot now. And a DH in the National League is going to be harder to build than an American League team, because American League teams have been playing that way for so long that NL teams, we saw it during interleague play, it's just they don't really know how to manage it right now. So if you've got the ability to bring in a Story or a Correa and sit them in that DH role, or at least put them in there at different points of the season, that opens that possibility up for them, which is why it's a little surprising that so many of these guys have signed already. Not so much in Texas, because you do have the DH in play and Simeon and Seager, all that stuff kind of mixes. It's all good. But in the National League, you got to wait to find out if this is going to be happening. And that's not the only piece that is involved in this potential lockout, which is now about an hour and a half away from being a reality right now. You've got playoff expansion. You've got patches on uniforms. You've got free agency issues, earlier ages of being paid, the service time manipulation stuff, tanking. So many pieces of this are going to be involved in these negotiations. And, you know, for the longest time, and you and I have talked about this, we talked about it last year during the COVID issues and all this stuff, we thought, okay, this is going to be one of those things that they're going to get it knocked out. They're going to figure out how to get this done. It's not going to be drag out, fight, dig your heels in, kind of thing. We thought, yeah, maybe there'd be some time lost. But the fact that today the union and the Players Association and the league, they all met today and it lasted all of 7 minutes before they went their separate ways and essentially declared no more talks, that right there put a little bit of tension in me that maybe this is going to be worse than we thought it was going to be. I mean, it could have just been one of those things like, hey, this is what you offer. This is what we offer. Yes, no, okay, now we got to figure out what we're going to do. And they just, there was no real point in talking today anyway. But is there any piece of you that sits there and go, okay, 7 minutes and nothing, and now we're going to be locked out? Is there any fear in you that this could last longer than, you know, into spring training?
I don't think so. I really don't. I mean, they did meet for about 45 minutes last night. So, you know, there was a little bit longer meeting last night. So, I mean, we knew this was coming. You know, I mean, we've known for a couple of years that, you know, the offseason was going to be screwed up more than likely this year. I think it's going to last for a while. I think it's probably going to last into mid to late January. I think cooler heads will prevail. I think both sides realize that they can't. It's to the detriment of the game of baseball if they miss spring training, if they miss any regular season games, if it gets pushed back. With everything that's gone on in this country the last couple of years, I think they understand that. I hope they do. If they don't, then, you know, we have even bigger issues than I thought. But I think it's going to take a while. But I think they'll have it. I think by the beginning of February, I think we'll be back and we'll have free agent frenzy for a couple of weeks, because you almost have to have it done by the 1st of February so the guys have time to, you know, sign contracts, figure stuff out, get guys to spring training, and have spring training start on time, because you really don't want to shorten spring training or any of those things either, you know, because we've seen what happens to players and teams when they don't get a full spring training. We have the injuries like we had at the first part of last season where everybody was falling left and right.
Oh, I thought you were alluding to the Greg Holland experience, but never mind.
Oh, there's that too. Yeah, you don't want to deal with that again either. That's something we don't ever want to see in St. Louis again. But yeah, I think it's going to be ugly. You know, I don't think we're going to hear a lot of positive stuff for the next few weeks probably. But I do think they will get it done. I think we'll have a full season. My God, they better not put patches on Major League Baseball uniforms. I don't think they will because of the fact baseball, you know, I understand it in hockey and basketball because you don't have a whole lot of room for signage, but you got enough damn room. There's enough signage at Busch Stadium as it is. They don't need to put patches on uniforms.
Well, I mean, think about all the digital ones that you see on the TV too. I mean, right. You've got digital ads in center field, like on the field itself when you're watching a game. So there's plenty of space and opportunity for you to put ads everywhere on a baseball state at a baseball stadium or on a baseball broadcast. So yeah, I don't get the whole patches thing on there as well. I mean, I don't know, you know, just reading it, it didn't sound like I couldn't determine whether if it was patches for advertisement or if it was like specialized patches that teams wanted to put on there to honor things or anything like that. I didn't get a good indication of if there was a difference between those, or if it was just kind of a blanket look. If a team wanted to sell an ad, they could, or if they wanted to put a patch on there to commemorate something, they could. I mean, there are a lot of commemorative patches that onto uniforms, right. So I don't think that's necessarily the direction they're going. But, you know, there's also the potential. I mean, you look at the NFL and, you know, the cleat thing is, I mean, let's not even get started on NFL yeah. uniform policy, because it's an absolute crapshoot for sure. But, you know, I don't, maybe in something in that vein where maybe it's a social justice patch or something that maybe it's not league wide or not specific to a, you know, the death of a player or the celebration of an anniversary or something like that. Maybe that's something that they want to discuss as well, that they want to throw in there. But still, I mean, adding anything more to uniforms might get a little bit nuts. So, yeah, I'm kind of not sure how that plays out as well. We talked a little bit about the playoff expansion as well. You got to think that they're going to come to an agreement on something as far as expansion is concerned, because it does benefit the players. It does benefit the owners, yes. So it's a two-way street. But if that does happen, do we potentially see – you talk about a full season. Is a full season still going to be 162 games, though? Are we going to see maybe a potential shortening of the season to allow for the expansion of playoff teams and playoff series?
I don't think so. I mean, I think they'll do, if anything, they'll go back to sort of what they were doing, you know, they used to do in the 50s and 60s, and you see double headers on Sundays. You do things like that where you open up some days. I mean, if they were going to shorten it, and there have been some talks, they would go back. I don't think it goes any shorter than the old days of 156. I don't think you go any shorter than that. I don't really think they're going to shorten it at all, because owners aren't going to want to lose that income. You know, and neither are players, because players, you know, players aren't going to want to lose that money, because owners are going to say, okay, we play seven less games, we pay you less. So I don't see that happening. You know, as far as the DH and the playoff expansion, those things are both going to happen because they're money makers for both sides. You know, of course, the playoffs, huge revenue for the owners as well as the players. You know, their postseason shares are huge. And then the DH just creates more jobs for guys as they get older. So it's something that the players and owners both want. So both of those things will happen.
The other thing that you have to talk about with this, and we've talked about this with the free agency signing that's going on. So at this point, and this is a number that's still growing because we're still seeing signings come in even at this point of the night. The Padres just signed a guy that I had never even heard of to a deal. Nick Martinez, I think is what his name was. No idea who he was. But right now we're at $1.6 billion and counting that have been awarded in contracts so far in free agency, and we're an hour and a half away from a lockout. This lockout is about money. So how can, as fans, how can we sit back? And I'm not going to sit there and say we're going to sit back and just accept this. It's something that's going to make us angry for sure. But how can you sit there and justify having a lockout about money when players are signing contracts for a ton of money and teams are giving out money like it's being printed, and yet both sides are complaining about money, yet they're making money hand over fist? You talked about it on Monday about, you know, last week about, or last year about DeWitt crying poor during the COVID lockout. Like, how do we justify this as being something that we want to go back to watching because it's millionaires fighting with billionaires?
Well, you know, I mean, it'll be one thing, like you said, if we miss games right now, the fact that they're locking the players out, you know, that doesn't bother me. I think, to me, in a lot of ways, locking the players out right now is the fastest way to get something accomplished. You know, it puts a sense of urgency to this whole thing for both sides, because both sides, you can't make moves, you can't do anything. You know, we need to get this done as quickly as possible. Whereas if you don't do that, there's no real sense of urgency, and you can drag this out all winter, and you get to spring training, oh, we don't have a collective bargaining agreement, then you have a lockout, then it gets ugly, then the fans get pissed. I don't think fans are going to be that upset about it as long as you get it done, you know, by the time the season started. Remember, what was it? Sam Bradford's second year, the NFL had that lockout, you know, that screwed the Rams over, you know, probably destroyed Sam Bradford's career the way that all worked out in a lot of ways. But, you know, fans didn't get upset about it because by the time training, you know, you missed a little bit of training camp, but by the time preseason was here, it was done and they were playing preseason games. And I think that's what will happen with this. I think by the time you get to spring training, in time for spring training games, everybody will be back on the field and people will have forgotten about it by the time you get to April.
Okay. And here's the other – this is the one piece that I guess because I'm not in it and not involved with it that I just can't see why it would be an issue. But there's the whole thing about minor league players – and about teams needing to provide, you know, housing and better quality and food and stuff to minor league players. And then on the flip side, you also have players that are fighting for things like social justice and other things that they're fighting for. How are we not able to find a way? Is it just because these guys don't want to part with their money, both players and teams, that there can't be some way to negotiate something in there that allows a portion of all money to go towards minor league teams, to go to helping promote social justice causes or health causes or something like that, to where, you know, these guys are making millions and millions of dollars. These teams are making billions and billions of dollars. How can we not find a way for them both to agree on something that would pool their money together? Maybe it's a one for two where every $1 million that players put into this pool, $2 million goes from teams or what have you, that will help with the minor league systems and help other causes that will make the players feel better and will also engender teams inside their community as well. I mean, I know that both sides do things for the community. Don't get me wrong. It's not something that they don't do. But with the amount of money that we're talking about right here, something more formalized. Is there a way for them to come up with something along those lines to help maybe make it a little bit more palatable for fans at seeing this kind of fight?
You know, I don't know. That's a hard thing to answer because not only do you have the players and the owners involved, then you have agents involved and agents saying, okay, well, we don't want our money or, you know, it's too hard. I think it's too complicated. I think it's easier for players to do and owners to do it the way they have done it. You know, because most players give tons of money and a lot of them don't want people to know what they're doing. And the same thing with ownership. I mean, look at what the Cardinals do every year, the millions and millions of dollars that they spend around St. Louis with different charitable acts and different things like that. I think it's just easier to do that than try to combine it and throw all those other factors into it. And I think you're going to have an even bigger fight. And as crazy as this sounds, there would be, and there's political ramifications to that too, because as crazy as it sounds, if they start a foundation and start giving money to social justice and this cause and that cause, you're going to piss off a certain group of your fan base. Whichever way you do it, you're not going to make people happy, and people are going to say, well, we're not going to support your team anymore because you believe in this, or you don't believe in this, or you're giving them money. Why aren't you giving us money? You know, it's just too big of a cluster to really make that work, I think, easily.
It is. It really is. I just sitting there just thinking about the millions and billions of dollars that are being exchanged between these two entities, and just the amount of craziness when you look at sports as a whole. I mean, we talked about Brian Kelly's contract with LSU being close to $100 million for 10 years. I mean, you've got the smallest amount of people making the largest amount of money. And I'm not saying that because I'm not one of them, because I'm not, but you know, there's something fundamentally wrong with it, but I'm still a huge sports fan, and I can't sit there and say that I'm not going to watch sports regardless of how much money these guys make. But it's just a really interesting topic that, you know, you would love to get players' perspective on, owners' perspective on as well, just to, you know, figure out, you know, is there a different way of doing it, or is there a better way of doing it, which right now they're doing a great job of it in a lot of instances.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's funny how people look at this too. I've had an argument with a couple of different people in the last couple of weeks. Look at these salaries. Baseball players are so greedy, blah, blah, blah. Athletes are so greedy. Well, you know how that stops? Ownership could stop it. If ownership doesn't agree to give somebody $45 million a year, is Max Scherzer going to say, oh, you're not giving me $45 million? I'm not playing at all this year. No, he's going to take, you know, the $30 million or the, you know, owners could stop this if they wanted to, but they don't. You know, they're the ones that keep agreeing to pay this money. If you say, no, we're not going to give you $380 million, is that guy, is Corey Seager going to quit playing baseball? Is he going to say, okay, well, then I don't play anymore? No. You know, as much as you want to blame the players for this, the owners are so much more responsible because they're the ones writing the checks and allowing it to get to the point that it has.
I mean, what's the American dream essentially is basically asking for the moon and accepting whatever is offered underneath that. I mean, if you're going to ask for the moon and they're going to give you the moon and Jupiter, you're crazy not to take both, right? I mean,
right. Yeah, no, yeah. I mean, it's insane. And you talked about, you know, that they're at $1.8 billion or whatever it is that we've signed in free agency and are probably going to break the all-time record. Just think about that. Think where they're at money-wise now and look at the guys that haven't signed yet. You mentioned Carlos Correa is going to be $300 million. Yep. Castellanos wants 8 or 9 years at $25 million. He wants somewhere in the $300 million range. Freddie Freeman's going to make $250, $300 million. You know, Story's could potentially make over $100 million. And there's a whole bunch of other guys that we haven't talked about yet that are going to get 70, 80, 90. I mean, you know, it's going to be astronomical how much money is spent in free agency this year. It's crazy. You know, it really is. I'm curious to see where Carlos Correa's market ends up. Does he end up making more than Corey Seager does? Or with all of the Astro cheating scandal and the comments he made about Derek Jeter not deserving any of the gold gloves that he won and things like that, are some of those things going to affect? I mean, there's a lot of people that have a bad taste in their mouth when it comes to Carlos Correa after the last few years. It'll be interesting to see if his market is where he thinks it should be.
Yeah, I agree. And I just want to get in here with some breaking news. John Heyman tweeted out about 3 minutes ago, MLB owners vote unanimously to institute a lockout. It's expected to begin tomorrow, but unclear as to what time. That's from John Heyman over on Twitter. That is blue checkmark verified, by the way, just so you guys know. It is blue checkmark verified. So we're not even going to be waiting until, you know, midnight tonight our time for us to find out if there's going to be a lockout or not. They are locked out. It's just going to be a matter of when this is going to start being instituted. So, we got a very interesting winter upcoming for Major League Baseball, something that we're going to be definitely keeping track of all winter. We're going to try and do our best to get some people that are in the know to join us and talk about that as well. I know we've been working the phones and the Twitters and the Facebooks trying to to line some people up to get some perspective on this as well. So make sure you stick with us over the winter for that. And now we got to jump over and talk a little bit about the St. Louis Blues, because I tell you what, man, after the first 5.5 minutes of that game last night, I was about done. But this Blues team did not quit last night. And as you can see here on the final score, Blues, a 4-3 shootout victory last night over the Tampa Bay Lightning. Tampa, like I said, 3 goals in the first 5 minutes and 29 seconds of the game, including, needless to say, probably one of the craziest looking goals you're going to ever see scored in a game. It bounced off of the partition in the glass, snuck in between Jordan Binnington's legs in for the goal 5 seconds after the second goal for the Lightning. But the Blues do come back. I mean, it's what they do. They had Ryan O'Reilly and Logan Brown in his first game with the Blues, scoring goals in the second period to make it 3-2. Ivan Barbashev gets a goal early in the third period, his fourth goal in the last three games. And then O'Reilly wins it in the shootout for the Blues, the only shootout goal for the win. Now, you got to take this with a grain of salt because there was no Steven Stamkos, no Nikita Kucherov, no Andrei Vasilevskiy for the Lightning. But still, I mean, looking at what the Blues have done this year, to be down 3-0 to the defending Stanley Cup champions and coming back and winning that game, fighting, crawling, clawing, getting themselves back into it, that's something to say the least. And Jordan Binnington after the game was essentially like, hey, look, I heard the fans when we were down 3-0, and then I heard the fans after we had won in the shootout. That's the game, and I love it. So, you know, his blood is a little bit thicker than I think a lot of people give him credit for. And, yes, he does go off on times, and he does blow up a little bit. But the composure he showed last night after letting in that third goal, the weird goal, not having Berube pull him, all that stuff, for him to kind of, like, lock it down and then stop the next 24 shots, including all the shootout shots, that shows you right there that I think Jordan Binnington has what it takes to be the number one goaltender. And I think what Ville Husso has done this year is giving him somebody that is going to push him to keep being that. I mean, that's just kind of what I see. It's still early in the season, but I'm liking what I see.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. I agree with you. And that was a huge win. Quick question. Who was more excited when we got that goal last night, Logan Brown or his dad, Jeff, watching that game? As we all know, Jeff's a longtime former Blues player.
Well, I'll put it this way. I got a chance to go to a Q&A with Jeff Brown a couple of years ago when the All-Star game was here in St. Louis. And he's a guy that did not have, I don't think he didn't have a whole lot of personality, very, very low key, very, very even keeled. So I'd say Logan Brown had more excitement, but I think showing it as far as showing it, Logan Brown had more, but I think Jeff Brown definitely had more excitement inside of him. I mean, anytime you see your offspring succeeding in a sport that they love and have grown up in, there's no feeling like it. So I'd have to say that Jeff Brown had more excitement, but Logan Brown was ecstatic out on the ice when he scored that goal.
Oh yeah. I mean, to grow up, you know, watching your dad play for the team, being a fan your whole life, and then to be able to come back and score that first goal in your first game with the Blues at home. I mean, that's just storybook kind of stuff.
Oh, it certainly is. It really, really is. And, you know, talking about some of the top performers, once again, you know, you get Ryan O'Reilly last night scoring the first goal of the game, and then you got the shootout goal. So he bookends the game for the Blues last night. He's got 6 points in his last 8 games. Now, he did have the COVID break, about 4 games that he missed. And when he came back, not great. 0 points in those first 5 games after that. But really, the last 8 games, he's kind of come back on. And It seems to be something that you're going to see with a lot of guys that go on the COVID list is, you know, you're out for, you know, 4, 5, 6 days, even a week as far as being out playing wise. And it's going to take a little while for you to get going again. And the fact that he's now starting to put some stuff together, and you add in Barbashev, he's got 4 goals his last 3 games. 2 of those have been power play goals in those 3 games, which is something you don't really necessarily hear is Barbashev in the power play. You got those 2 guys going really well. You've got, you know, David Perron's out. Clem Costin's out. Robert Thomas has elevated his game for sure. Brandon Saad's kind of been in and out the last couple of weeks, really. But he's another guy that's coming back from being on the COVID list as well. So this team has not been fully healthy, but I think 1 game this year, and yet they're still sitting in second place in the Central. You get these guys back from COVID list, from the injured reserve, get them a couple weeks under their belt. This could be a scary team going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've talked about it. There's definitely the potential there. And, you know, they've just run into tough luck with so many people injured and COVID and everything else. But I think they definitely have a shot to make a run. And it'll be fun as we get into the end of December. Well, we're in early December now, but as we get into the month of December and then into January, and, you know, everybody will be focused on the Blues because there's no hot stove baseball to talk about. So, yeah, everybody will be really, really focused on the Blues as they start to make that run and you start to make that turn, you know, into the crunch time part of the season as you get into January and then February at the trade deadline and all of that fun stuff. But this team will be fun. What do you think? You know, we talked about, you know, if Tarasenko got moved, it would be at the trade deadline. I don't see that happening. I don't see Vladdy getting traded till maybe, you know, if he still wants to be traded. I think it's something that maybe happens around the draft now. What do you think?
I think you're probably right in that sense. I mean, he's been by far probably the Blues' best player this year. You could see the passion in his eyes. The work ethic is there. The desire, the want is there. And it's not like he's going out there trying to do it all for himself. He is still doing this for the team. You know, the fact that he's on that line with Buchnevich and Barbashev, the Russian line took hold in that game against Columbus on Saturday night. And you could just see the camaraderie and the just the fellowship that those guys had together. And yes, that's one thing playing with your line mates from the same country, but it really feels like he's still embracing the team aspect of it, and he's not having any bad blood towards the team itself. Yes, maybe he doesn't like something going on with the medical staff, or maybe there's something going on with management, but Tarasenko has been the consummate professional in the sense that he is still doing things for the team because, yes, it will make him look good. It will make his trade value go up, but he's not doing it just for himself, too. He wants to go out there and win, and he's doing it for the city of St. Louis. He's always praised the city of St. Louis, wanting to bring the Stanley Cup here. The Blues did that. He's happy for that, but I really just think he likes the embracement of St. Louis and what this city has meant to him, and he wants to continue to provide for them whether or not he gets traded from here. And I'll be honest. I mean, if the team still stays up near the top and they got a chance to win another Stanley Cup this year, I don't see him pushing to be traded at the deadline. Now, if this team's sitting at, you know, fourth or fifth in the division and kind of on that playoff bubble, yeah, maybe you look at it and go, okay, we had our run. Let me go somewhere. Maybe I could be that last piece that makes an impact at the top of the standings and go from there. But I think with seeing some of these other teams play in our division right now, including Colorado giving up 8 goals tonight, this team's going to be right there. And I don't think you move any part that doesn't make you better. And moving Tarasenko right now does not make you better.
No, I agree. I agree. I think he's here for the long haul, or at least the rest of the season. So, yeah, it's nice to see him out there playing and looking a lot like the Vladdy that we all remember when he was in his prime and this team was rolling.
Yeah, and, you know, we've got another game against Tampa tomorrow night in Tampa. They travel to Florida on Saturday to play the Panthers, and then the Panthers are back here next Tuesday. So a little bit of a Florida run here before a 4-game homestand, Florida, Detroit, Montreal, and Anaheim, and then a back-to-back with Dallas. So a couple of home-and-home series coming up here for the Blues with the Lightning, the Panthers, and then the Stars. And then you talk about getting into that crunch of the middle of the season. Don't forget the Olympics are coming up in February. There is a total of 1 home game for the Blues in the month of February. And honestly, there's just a total of 4 games in February for the NHL because of that 2-week Olympic break, which for me is great because I love Olympic hockey, seeing NHL players play for their countries. You know, obviously Vladimir Tarasenko is one of those. That might be another reason why he's really pushing himself this year. He wants to be included into that Russian or Athletes of Russia or whatever they're going to call themselves team for the Olympics. So there's another piece that you have to add into that as well. And, you know, you've got other guys, Ryan O'Reilly, Scott Perunovic might be a guy that sneaks into the Olympic conversation as well. So you've got that coming up in February. So that's going to be a real interesting piece as well, because if a team like the Blues are rolling going into February, what does that break do to them? And what does that break do to them going into the trade deadline? Like you said, it's just going to be a very, very interesting time of year. And if we're talking about, you know, Olympics, NHL trade deadline, and the Major League Baseball hot stove reigniting in the month of February, I think we're going to have plenty of content going forward for this winter for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I keep forgetting that the Winter Olympics are this year. It seems like we just had them. And just a quick note to NBC, when the Olympics start, can we get some kind of television coverage of something besides figure skating? Every time I tried to watch the Olympics last time, it was like nothing but figure skating. And I realized figure skating is popular in the Olympics, but we don't need 24/7 figure skating. There's other events.
I want to see more bobsled. I want to see more skeleton. Those two are a lot of fun. And the luge. I mean, you can't forget the luge. I mean, that's a lot of fun. I really do like those events. Obviously, hockey is going to be a big one. You know, the Winter Olympics are a lot different than the Summer Olympics. Obviously, there's less sports being played. And it seems like a lot of those sports are more selective because you've got a lot of skiing. You've got a lot of, you know, trap shooting, things like that going on that seem to only hit a certain niche kind of group. And I feel like, and I think the reason why figure skating is so much highly covered is it's like swimming in a sense that it's something that technically probably everyone can do. It's readily available. Everybody can go ice skating because all you need is a pair of skates. And yes, I know skates are expensive, but it's just a pair of skates. Swimming, it's just getting into a pool somewhere. Yes, not everybody has a pool, but you can go to a community one, that sort of thing. So I can see why those are the two like headliners for sure. But yeah, I want to see more bobsled, skeleton, luge. I definitely want to see plenty of hockey going on. Snowboarding is going to be another one that's going to be big again this year. I'm very excited to see that. Never been snowboarding in my life, but I love watching it for sure. Same as skateboarding in the Olympics.
Oh, man, snowboarding is funny. You need to go out to Hidden Valley, man.
I've never been there. 36 years here. I've never been to Hidden Valley.
Oh, man, snowboarding in Hidden Valley. Lots of good times. Probably was out there. Their midnight jamborees at Hidden Valley on a snowboard in shape that I should not have been on a Friday or Saturday night in my younger years. We'll just leave it at that. But yeah, a lot of good memories out there. And you know what I really want to see in the Olympic? I want to see 24/7 nothing but curling, just a whole bunch of curling. And I need to look it up because former St. Louis Ram quarterback Mark Bulger was trying to make the Olympic curling team. Yep. I'm not sure if he did or not, but I know that he was like one of the finalists to make the team.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they've actually had their world finals yet or not. That would definitely be something to look at because, yeah, I did see that story as well that he is trying to become an Olympic curler, and I don't think he's the only former football player in that grouping either.
Right, yeah, I think the whole team, I don't remember now who all was involved, but yeah, there were three or four of them, and hopefully he can curl better than he can throw a football.
He can throw a football pretty well. Let's not poo-poo his career. I mean, I'm not saying he was no Kurt Warner, but he was able to play pretty well for the Rams in his time here. He was just like Bradford, under a lot of pressure. His offensive lines deteriorated in his time here.
Yeah. He was okay for a couple of years. And then, yes, I'll give you the offensive line got worse, but he definitely regressed during his time in St. Louis. Let's just leave it at that.
That he did. Well, looking at the Bulger thing, Bulger, along with fellow former NFLers Jared Allen, Keith Bullock, and Michael Ruse, are trying to qualify for the Olympics. So, yes, that's right. Jared Allen is a part of that group as well. And apparently it looks like Bulger has a curling bar in West Nashville as well. So, I mean, he's really leaning into this, this curling thing for sure. He's also looking into bowling as well. So Mark Bulger doing a lot entrepreneurially in the Nashville area. And it's kind of crazy. There's a lot of stuff, former St. Louisans in the Nashville area. We had Louis Bartechko on a couple months ago. He's in the Nashville area. Brett Hull's down in the Nashville area as well. So Nashville's kind of becoming, and I don't want to put these two together, but it's almost like a St. Louis South in a sense that St. Louis has a hub of players, and now Nashville's getting that hub as well. And that's pretty interesting to say the least.
Yeah. Yeah, Nashville, definitely a hot spot. Like you said, there's lots of connections between St. Louis and Nashville. Have to go down and hang out in Nashville and run into Mark Bulger. We can curl and bowl. I know somebody that we used to be close to that would be like his dream trip right there.
It probably would be. Yeah, I mean, And
in Nashville, he could sing. Man, that would be the ideal trip for that guy.
Well, you know what? We'll do it ourselves, and if it's a really fun experience, we'll suggest it. You know, be the olive branch for sure. NFL Thursday Night Football tomorrow night. I don't know if you really want to talk about this because it's the Cowboys and the Saints. Cowboys coming off that Thanksgiving Day loss to the Raiders, still in the lead in the NFC, but they've lost three of their last four games. Like you said last week or on Monday as well, that you know they're starting to finally play the teams that are actually good, and we're seeing kind of what the Cowboys are. Now, Amari Cooper is going to be back for tomorrow night's game. Not sure how much he's going to play, but he is going to play tomorrow night. And the Saints are starting Taysom Hill. He is not been great this year. He just signed another extension with the Saints. May have Alvin Kamara back tomorrow. Still a couple of offensive tackles questionable as well for this game. And the Saints have lost four straight as well. So neither one of these teams is really firing on all cylinders going into this matchup. I'm not really sure which way I'm leaning in this one. I think I'm going Cowboys in this matchup just because Cooper coming back does give them another weapon. They haven't looked great offensively this the last couple of weeks. I mean, last week, I think 65 yards rushing on 20 carries. That's just terrible when you've got a guy like Zeke. But now you're throwing Cooper in there, gives them another weapon that may spread that defense out. I think I'm going to go with the Cowboys on this one, and I think I feel comfortable in making that pick.
I'm going to go Dallas, too. I don't feel comfortable at all because watch Taysom Hill like run for 150 yards and throw for like 350 or something. Yeah, I mean, Dallas seems like they should be the safe pick there, but it wouldn't shock me at all if the Saints blew them out like 38-3 or something, because that's just the way the league has gone this year.
And it's in New Orleans as well, so you've got the Superdome aspect to it as well, and not saying that the fans are like Seattle, but it is a tough, tough place to play in. So it would not, like you said, surprise me if the Saints do kind of get behind their fans and use that to their advantage for sure. It's been a long, tough struggle for the Saints this year. They were in playoff contention for a little while, but this four-game losing streak has really kind of pushed them off to the edge there. So it should be a really interesting game. You know, the Washington football team is charging hard at the backside of the Cowboys, really looking to see if they can, you know, take over that top spot in the West. You know, they've got a big game going up against the Raiders this week in Las Vegas. So that actually should be a really, really fun game. There's a lot of really intriguing games this week. Looking ahead to Sunday for sure. I mean, you've got Arizona at Chicago. I'm not going to say that's an intriguing game, but you get to see Kyler Murray and DeAndre Hopkins probably coming back after a couple of weeks off, so that should be interesting. The Chargers at Cincinnati. That's a real, real intriguing game for me because I have both Joe Burrow and Herbert in my fantasy team, so I got to figure out who I'm going to play first of all. And really, the Chargers have not looked all that great the last couple of weeks, which is surprising because I thought they were a team that could challenge the Chiefs for that AFC West title, but they just have not looked good. What are your thoughts on that Chargers-Bengals game?
That's another one that you look at it and you know you say, okay, Cincinnati's really played well here lately. The Chargers have struggled. But the way this season has gone, that's about the time that all of a sudden Cincinnati will fall flat on their face now for the next couple of weeks and not be able to do anything in San Diego. The Chargers turn it on and win a couple in a row. So, you know, it's really a coin flip. You got two of the best young quarterbacks in the league. You know, you got exciting playmakers on both teams. You know, it could really honestly go either way, but I think I'm going to go Cincinnati. But, again, could very easily be the opposite. Chargers could take that game.
And it's subject to change. Our final picks don't have to be in until Sunday morning. So if something happens as far as injuries are concerned, or maybe just a change of heart, that's not set in stone. Although the Dallas pick now is set in stone. The other game, Monday night, holy moly, who would have thought that New England at Buffalo could be a linchpin game for both of these teams? And not so much in the conventional system as thinking that Buffalo would be in first place and maybe looking to lock in a first round bye, but more so the fact that the Patriots are in first place, looking like the best team in the AFC, and Buffalo is still right there as well. But this could be a game that essentially locks up that AFC East for the New England Patriots. Mac Jones looked good. He's got some chemistry going with his wide receivers. This is a really scary potential team in New England. And you add in the fact that if they get the home field advantage throughout the playoffs, even without Tom Brady there, that's a tough place to play up in Foxborough.
Yeah, it will be because you get in the playoffs, it'll be cold, it could be snowy, it'll be windy. Kind of the same things you run into when you go to Buffalo in a playoff game or a late December game. I think the Bills win this game. I mean, I know New England has looked really good and Mac Jones has looked good. But I think top to bottom, Buffalo is a better, more talented football team. So I think you see Josh Allen kind of step up, and I think the Bills win this one. I think it'll be close, but I think the Bills win.
I think the Bills have to win this game, and not so much to get back into first place, but I, you know, yes, they've beaten New England once this year. They beat them last year with Cam Newton, but I still think this is one of those things that New England still holds a little bit, just a little bit still on the Buffalo Bills. And if the Patriots come into Buffalo and beat them on Monday night, that thing goes from here and it's back to that half, oh my gosh, we can never beat the Patriots regardless of who plays for them kind of thought process in the Bills' head. So I almost feel like the Bills have to win this one. And if they do, it might completely exercise those demons and might give this rivalry something that either team can go into it year in and year out and win in these rivalry games. And this one's going to be one for a while with Mac Jones and Josh Allen being young quarterbacks. This is one of those, you know, matchups for the next 4 or 5 years that's going to be really, really good. And it'll be that much better if Buffalo wins this game on Monday night against the Patriots. So I think I'm leaning to the Bills as well, but I want to wait to make that pick once more until I see a little bit more about who might be playing, who might be out. So right now, leaning towards Buffalo. Official pick will be coming in on Sunday morning for sure. Man, I know that we kind of put out some bad news about the lockout tonight, about it being unanimously voted on by the union or by the owners to go into effect starting tomorrow at some point. A little bit of a downer there, but still a lot of great stuff going out tonight. Anything else you want to talk about before we head out?
No, I think that's pretty much it. You know, a lot going on in the sports world right now. And, you know, here in the next couple of weeks, we're really going to have to start digging into some college basketball. We haven't talked a whole lot about it because we're still in the early stages. You know, you're playing the blood donors a lot of the time. But the Billikens looking like they could be good, even though they've had some injuries hit them early. So we're going to have to really dig into the Billikens as we get closer to A-10 conference play. And that'll be right around the corner. And then, you know, Mizzou, unfortunately, is the Jekyll and Hyde that we've seen at Mizzou for the last few years with that basketball team. Although you kind of have to expect that when you have a whole new, I mean, pretty much the whole team transferred out last year and you brought in a whole new team. So it's going to take a little while for that to all kind of blend together and mesh and be consistent. But yeah, we'll have to really start digging into some college basketball here as we get closer to the holidays. The bragging rights game will be here before we know it. And then just one last thing before we knock this out. We haven't talked about it a whole lot the last couple of shows that we've done, but you can still donate to the Real Men Wear Pink campaign. I know October's over and, you know, the real push of the Real Men Wear Pink campaign kind of dies down at the end of October when Breast Cancer Awareness Month is over, but the fight against breast cancer awareness never goes away. So, you know, all of those donation portals are still open. They'll be open till the end of the year. So you can go out there and, give a little money to breast cancer awareness. Help make that fight. Make that your charitable donation as we move through the holiday season and help somebody fight the breast cancer disease.
Yeah, because cancer is not a one-month kind of thing. It's an everyday battle for a lot of people, and it's not just a one-month kind of donation run. You can donate throughout the year. You can do a lot of different things to help support cancer research and the development of new ways to fight this dreaded disease. So yeah, definitely make sure to get out there and donate whatever you can. It's a great charitable gift for the holidays, and you know, it's a great write-off as well, you know, a charitable donation for your taxes upcoming this year as well. So you know, it's for a great cause, so make sure you go out and do that as well. Yeah, and I want to thank you guys for joining us once again. We got a lot of great things still in store for the rest of this year and leading into next year, so make sure you stick with us here on the Toasted Tavern. We are back and better than ever. I'll leave it at that. We made it through the wilderness, and now we are going to be going ahead full steam. So make sure you check that out and come back for more Toasted Tavern here at 9 o'clock during the week, and maybe a couple of additional surprises throughout the weekends and ahead as well. So make sure you stick around for that. For Scott, I am Wags. Thank you guys for joining us, and we'll see you guys very, very soon.
Hey, it's you, man, here from Casey. For all your sports news, catch the Toasted Tavern with Scott Tobin and the man called Wags weeknights at 9 p.m. You can follow Toasted Tavern on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Let's get toasted.